going to spend some time today talking about a community-based genomic medicine initiative that we have launched in Guilford County, North Carolina. And generally, what I want to do is share with you some of the things that we've been encountering as we attempt to get this program off the ground, and where we're beginning to encounter, I think, some issues that are critically important. And I also want to make a couple of points, or emphasize a couple of points, relating to our initiative that I think are important to convey in a more general sense. What we've seen from the previous talks is that really genomic medicine is about risk stratification based on family history and genetic information. So the idea here then is that people are assigned in risk categories, and if they're in an unusually high risk category, some sort of intervention or some sort of treatment will be undertaken so that that person can maintain good health or avoid or at least minimize their chances for disease. The second point I want to bring out, so it's about risk stratification and avoidance of disease. Maintaining good health is what genomic medicine's goal really is. The second point I want to make is that family history is a form of genetic information. And when we look at this from the standpoint of rights of confidentiality and privacy, what we can see immediately is that all of us are impacted now by the potential of genetic discrimination as it pertains to our healthcare system. In fact, family history is still the most robust indicator of certain diseases like colorectal cancer and breast ovarian cancer. It supersedes even genetic testing results. And that brings me to a point, which is, in allocating health resources, there becomes a question about what is sensible risk assessment based on clinical evidence, and what is simply denying someone access to health care. Because if we're using risk stratification, we have to make some decisions about when it's appropriate to apply an intervention, and also some decisions about when it's appropriate not to apply an intervention. So my talk is broken down into a couple of subcategories here. I'm going to talk briefly about our genomic medicine model and its relationship to public health. I also want to spend a little bit of time talking about the value of genomic approaches in healthcare. I'm going to talk about colorectal cancer screening. The question really here is this worth pursuing, given the fact that we are creating some issues on the other side of it? I'm then going to talk a little bit about the need for protection from genetic discrimination that we're encountering in our own program, and give you a little bit of information about current and pending legislation. The development of our genomic medicine initiative has focused on the use of this particular model, which we call a dialogue model. We made it up, okay, so bear with me here. But when we think about the patient and provider and think about risk stratification and interventions, what we can see is that the patient needs to bring a certain amount of information, family medical history, some perception about risk, and a willingness at least to talk about risk reduction through some sort of consultation. The provider has to bring information and knowledge about risk assessment. And then, of course, after this dialogue, which our hospital administrators tell us can't take more than about 7 minutes, on the backside of this, we need to somehow see something happen in terms of the doctor or the provider, in terms of follow-up, surveillance, screening and treatments, referrals as necessary, and on the patient's side, some sort of action, some sort of risk reduction, some action that will lead to risk reduction. Now, I'm going to focus on this today because I think this is an extremely important point. Even before the patient is a patient, they're members of the community, and one of the things that I hope to bring out in this discussion is the fact that we really need to be proactive in dealing with this particular issue and talking to people even before they may recognize their patients in genomic medicine. So I want to spend a little bit of time here talking about the potential value, and I'm talking here about now the human right to health and access to health care, and thinking about genomic medicine and what's possible here. You may remember from Dr. Jones's presentation this particular table, which is a table that shows risk as a function of numbers of family members who have developed colorectal cancer. I'll note that this could also be an actuarial table for an insurance company. If we look at colorectal cancer, what we find is actually the majority of colorectal cancers, 70 to 75%, are sporadic. That is, they occur in individuals for which there's no family history. I'll also note that typically sporadic colorectal cancers occur after the age of 60. But in this other category, we have a group of people who clearly have a hereditary form of colorectal cancer. However, and this is not, I think, generally appreciated, the vast majority of people who have a family history of colorectal cancer and therefore are at elevated risk for cancer do not carry a mutation that's associated with colorectal cancer. In other words, family history is our best indicator of their risk. This reminds me that I want to share with you some back-of-the-envelope calculations about what colorectal cancer screening can mean on the basis of risk stratification. And I'll present a little bit of information here as background. If we look at the general population, we can see that the lifetime incidence of colorectal cancer is 4% for those with no family history of CRC. It's about 6% overall. Now, we saw from the previous pie chart that about a quarter, 25% of CRC cases are familial or hereditary. In other words, about 1.5% of the population is in fact at an elevated risk for developing colorectal cancer based on something we can discern in their family history and genetics. In a population like ours in Guilford County of approximately 500,000 people, what that translates into is that at any given time we have about 7,500 people who are at an elevated risk for colorectal cancer. And for those people with a family history, the recommendation is that their colonoscopies would begin at age 40 or even sooner if somebody in the family developed colorectal cancer at a relatively early age. Now, one of the points I really want to bring out here is that this information conveys the fact that these 7,500 people are at elevated risk. What it doesn't tell you is their insurance status. Some of these people may be covered by group insurance. Some of these people may be covered by individual insurance. Some of these people may have no insurance at all. And so we run into a real issue here about access to healthcare when we start thinking about a specific risk like colorectal cancer, which is a life-threatening disease, and for which a relatively simple intervention can result in a complete avoidance of colorectal cancer. I'll note that another problem here is that even for people who are insured, insurance companies are sometimes reluctant to reimburse for colonoscopies that are based on some deviation from the general recommendations based on a family history. Well, if we continue on about what this means in terms of public health, the cost of a colonoscopy is about $2,500 once every 5 years. Now remember, I'm talking about those people who are in a high-risk category and would be recommended for a colonoscopy beginning at age 40 rather than the standard recommendation of age 50. And we can see that at that rate, those 7,500 at-risk individuals, if everybody got a colonoscopy, it would be about $3.8 million a year over that 10-year span, or $38 million. The rate at which people in these categories are found to have polyps that lead to cancer is about 5%. That is about 1 out of every 20 colonoscopies administered in this population before the age of 50 is going to reveal a polyp that is potentially cancerous. The average cost of CRC treatment in those 375 patients, that is those 1 in 20 of the 7,500, is $250,000 per person, or about $93 million. And what you can see here is that just looking at the arithmetic, it's a sensible idea that people who have a risk for colorectal cancer on the basis of family history ought to get colonoscopies and ought to get reimbursement for this at the age of 40. If for no other reason, that it economically makes a lot of sense for the healthcare system, but obviously also because these people can avoid a life-threatening disease and all the torment and costs that go with it. So when we look at it from this perspective, it makes a lot of sense, but embedded within this is there has to be some sort of cooperation within the system, both in the form of collecting family history information and genetic information where necessary and protecting it, and also providing the reimbursements that allow for these people to avoid the disease altogether. And so I didn't quote anybody else. I made this up myself, and I'm sharing it with you. Realizing the potential benefits of genomic approaches requires laws that protect against discrimination resulting from family history and genetic information. And now what I'd like to do is spend a little bit of time talking about the current status of affairs in the United States. And the United States, I think, is a place where, by the way, this issue is important. I know this is an international forum, but I think the rubber meets the road here in the United States at this particular point. In fact, there are a number of states which have some sort of legislation protecting against genetic discrimination. In fact, here, if we look at these states in light yellow, you can see that the vast majority of states have some form of legislation protecting against genetic discrimination in, and I'm talking here specifically about health insurance coverage. However, if we start to look at these laws a little bit more carefully, what you find is that almost none of them are comprehensive. What you find, for example, is that of the 50 states, only 44 provide for some sort of prohibition so that insurance companies cannot use genetic information to determine health insurance liability. 42 states mandate that insurance companies cannot use genetic information for risk assessment or classification, which in another sense is the essence of genomic medicine. 27 states protect against disclosure of genetic information without informed consent. 26 states require that insurance companies are not allowed to ask for genetic tests or genetic information as a condition for coverage. And 42 of the 50 states protect both group insured and individually insured individuals. When you add it all up, what you find is that there's only 12 states that offer coverage in all four of those specific health insurance issues. Mind you, I have not even spoken about employment discrimination. And there's three states, shown in red here, which have no legislation whatsoever to protect individuals. Now, you might feel kind of lucky if you live in one of these gold states, but let me point out that if you move to a different state at some point, you lose all that protection. And that leads me to federal legislation that's pending just a few blocks from here in the U.S. Senate at this particular time. It's the Federal Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, GINA, Senate Bill S-358. Let me give you a little bit of background here about this particular bill, which is pending in Congress in this session. It passed the House of Representatives earlier this year and is currently pending in the U.S. Senate. The President has indicated that he will sign the legislation. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that. Has agreed to sign the legislation passed by Congress, presuming, of course, that it passes through the Congress. I also want to make you aware of a website, www.geneticalliance.org, which offers the opportunity to everybody to provide support. It gives information about GINA and also gives you the opportunity to send some sort of letter to your congressional representatives in support of this particular bill. Let me talk a little bit about the provisions of the bill. It does protect both family history and genetic test information, and I do want to stress that family history, I believe, is because it's so easily accessible, is just as important to cover, maybe even more important to cover for many of us than the genetic tests, which many of us may never have. It provides broad protection. That is, it addresses all of the four issues that I raised in that previous slide with regards to state legislation. It protects against employment discrimination. And it protects those who have a genetically based symptom. That is, if somebody has a genetically based disorder and it's producing symptoms, they are covered. I will note that the bill does not protect against everything. For example, people who develop symptoms based on a genetic risk or genetically based risk would not be covered if, in fact, they started to develop symptoms before seeking coverage. It does not cover disability or life insurance. So let me conclude with a couple of slides here about some points that I hope to share with all of you as members of your own community. Family member does provide an important piece of information about an individual's disease risk. And in many instances, there are interventions and lifestyle choices that can reduce disease risk and or promote good health. Let me get on my soapbox for one moment and say that I think that one of the important aspects of genomic medicine is not merely avoiding disease, but actually promoting good health. And my hope is that the studies will show that family history is actually a motivational device by which people can personalize their sense of risk as it pertains to their health. Family history indicates that genetic testing may be informative for a subset of individuals, so there's a way in which genetic testing could be applied cost-effectively. And I think another important point, and this relates to community education, is that individuals must consider privacy and confidentiality issues when making decisions based on family history and genetics. You may not realize that genetic counselors in their sessions with people who are at risk are, in fact, one of the things that they cover is insurance options and implications. I think that we need to continue to have that sort of education, but we also need to educate people on the front end about issues of privacy and confidentiality. In other words, be transparent in presenting this to the public. And finally, my general conclusions here. Family history and genetic information are useful for implementing personalized interventions that promote health and reduce disease risk. I also want to offer up the notion that family history really offers a very cost-effective strategy for promoting public health as a part of community screening programs for adult-onset diseases. What we found is that many of our community-based screening programs do not include a risk assessment based on family members who may have developed life-threatening diseases like breast or colon cancer. And this might be a way to implement a cost-effective strategy that focuses in on high-risk individuals. Realizing the full potential of using genomic approaches does, however, depend upon having enforceable laws that protect against genetic discrimination. And I guess I'll add another editorial comment, which is that universal coverage increases the incentives for using genomic medicine. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, are there any questions for any of the four speakers? Yes.
As I understand the law, they would be protected, as I understand it. But I can tell you that one of the things that I have embarked upon is going through this legislation to try to unravel some of the cases like you're talking about, because when you start to talk about specific instances, there are a lot of variations on these particular issues. As I understand the legislation from my reading, it would protect the